Chris Pallister, president and co-founder of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, and Patty Zwalow, scientist and professor at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and Henry Reiske, marine debris coordinator with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Just want to start out, we can talk to Chris here, and just want to explain what Gulf of Alaska Keeper is, how long you guys have been going, and what you guys have been doing.
We're a conservation nonprofit. Our primary focus is the marine debris problem. We have been around since, I think we incorporated in 2005, and we've been doing serious marine debris projects ever since.
Okay, and so I was actually able to join you guys out at Gore Point on the outer coast of the peninsula just a few weeks ago and kind of got a look into how things work. And this is pretty slow-paced work. I mean, you're picking up small pieces of plastic and log jams are on pretty long beaches. I mean, you guys have been doing this year after year?
Yeah, we have been, and we generally have a full-time crew working in the summer, and they'll spend up to 100 days just walking down beaches cleaning up trash, and as you see, there's a pretty heavy load out there.
Yeah, and so just looking at some of the data from Gore Point, it looks like just in, what, about 6 days that you guys were out there total?
We actually were 4 days on those beaches.
Okay, so just in 4 days, about 10,432 pounds of trash were picked up. And you said that's almost nothing compared to some other beaches that you guys work on.
Right, and Gore Point is, you have to understand, is a monitoring site, which we generally clean on an annual basis. So what you see there is what just came up in the past year. This last trip to Gore Point was a two-year hiatus since we last cleaned it, but tremendous amount of stuff comes up every year.
Yeah, and so if you just want to explain, you know, a lot of the stuff we were seeing was coming from Asian countries. We saw a lot of water bottles from the 2008 Olympics in China, a lot of aquaculture crates with, a lot of things with Japanese and Chinese writing on them. Where is this debris coming from, and how is it getting into the ocean?
There's a lot of sources that are getting into the Pacific, and China, Korea, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, have been identified as some of the worst marine debris polluters in the world. And so that's a lot of that is poor landfill practices, disposal practices. But then, of course, there's tsunamis, there's typhoons and things like that that contribute a lot of debris to the marine environment. And the Japanese stuff is largely from the tsunami. The stuff we find from China and Korea and the rest of them is just bad disposal practices.
Okay, and just looking at some of the news coverage, coming out, it sounds like their economic growth is just a lot faster than their landfill practices. Is that what you've been seeing?
Absolutely, and you look at a lot of these places, they're just coming into the modern world, and it's always been that you could throw stuff away in the past. Well, nowadays you can't throw things away because they don't decompose, they don't biodegrade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so. Why is it that when that stuff makes its way into the ocean over in these Asian countries that it's ending up here in Alaska?
Well, it's both the currents and the storm patterns that really influence it. And you have the subtropical gyre, and you have the Alaska gyre, and you have the Alaska Coastal Current, and they all work together to drive stuff toward the northern Canadian coast in the southeast Alaska, and then the winter storms and stuff in Alaska Current bring it right up around into the northern Gulf and really impact. The northern Gulf is probably the worst of all the coastline in Alaska.
Okay, and so, people might be asking why I go out and catch Mac Bay and I don't see this problem. Why are we seeing it out on these other beaches like Gore Point or out in Prince William Sound, where you also work on Montague Island? Why are those particular areas getting more than others?
Well, if you look at the winter storm tracks, the historic storm tracks, a lot of that debris is coming from storms that blow from the southeast. And then you look at outside of Montague and outside of Kenai Peninsula and Kayak Island and Kodiak Island, all of them are facing that direction. And so the storms and the currents bringing all the stuff out of the Pacific, and then it gets driven right up on that shoreline. There's a lot of really excellent trapping structure out there that holds on to all that debris, too.
And And so now when you guys go out there and collect this debris, you know, gotta see your sorting process. And we're going to also talk to Micah about this because she's kind of a key part of that. You guys sort, it's not just collecting the stuff, putting it in bags and being done with it. You guys sort this into categories and really kind of keep track of what's coming on our shores.
Yeah, so we do. We track, I think, a little over 150 categories of debris. I think on this last project at Gore Point, we identified like close to 11,000 different single items. That's not counting the countless pieces of styrofoam and broken unidentifiable little pieces of plastic. This is like bottles and baskets and buckets and barrels and all that stuff. So you think about that, we pick it all up by hand and then you sort it out on these categories and you count it all. That's a lot of work that goes into this.
Yeah. And so what is the benefit of getting it into these categories? I mean, what purpose is that serving?
Policymakers want to know where it's coming from and who's responsible. And ultimately we have to figure that out if we're ever going to develop a way to stop this. And as we've talked about before, it's really difficult issue when you have shippers and the commercial fishing industry and all these foreign countries contributing to this problem. And it's easy to pass the blame on to somebody else, but you have to have numbers, you have to have proof before we're going to get anywhere with this.
Yeah, and so you guys have categories for like fishing lines, you know, you even break down the water bottles into domestic, foreign, and those types of categories. And so, Micah, you help keep track of some of this data. And you guys have seen some interesting trends, mostly surrounding the tsunami.
Right, yeah. So one trend we saw was the styrofoam. So in the tsunami was in 2011, I think in March. And that summer we could start seeing styrofoam levels going up on different beaches. And it peaked in 2012. And it is not a little bit of an increase, but like 20 to 100-fold increase. So that's real, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been another trend, again, linked to the tsunami, which were the baskets, those fishing baskets that the Japanese fishermen used. And that didn't peak until 2015. And again, it was very clear that this was tsunami debris because it had the Japanese markings on it.
And you guys have been looking at this as far as, like the Japanese aquaculture baskets are something that might sit below the surface. They're not going to be a wind-driven item, so that's why we were seeing these lighter items. And I know, Chris, you pointed out a little piece of plastic, and immediately you knew that was an aquaculture stake from the aquaculture industry over in the Asian countries. And so a lot of those wind-driven items showed up very quickly. And so now we're still continuing to see some of this heavier debris wash up on shores. And you guys, Micah, we were talking last time, you said there's so many more things you guys would like to answer through this data, but it would just take so much work to dive through it.
Yes, I mean, I think the data set is really large at this point. I mean, we have data since 2008. And if you think about 150 categories and not just looking at Gore Point, three different beaches, but also we have 14 beaches in Prince William Sound that we look at. So it's a massive amount of data that would be very interesting to look at a lot more patterns. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it would be important to be able to do it because, you know, the information, I think one example that's probably really clear to a lot of people is the styrofoam. I mean, the fact that this came so quickly would really be important to instruct, you know, agencies to help clean it up quickly because, as Chris can tell you, styrofoam came in very large foam floats from the fishermen, but within months that breaks down in very tiny pieces and it becomes impossible to clean it up. So if you have that information from the numbers, you have a good argument to get money quickly to help clean it up.
And so a lot of this is being able to inform the people making the decisions. And Chris, we're talking about, you know, you guys are out there year after year cleaning up a lot of this debris, and it washes up a lot faster than you guys can pick it up. I mean, it just, I remember sitting in a spot for about 45 minutes and not being able to clean up the whole entire thing. You said, but you're not really defeated though. You said that top down legislation is kind of what you're looking for. You think that's kind of the solution?
I really do believe that, you know, grassroots only get you so far, and the grassroots is important for pushing the policymakers. But once the policymakers develop an umbrella legislation that impacts not just us nationally but internationally, then things will happen. I mean, you look, we had horrible water pollution problems in this country until we got the Clean Water Act, and the same way the Clean Air Act, all that. Once we got those, things really happened. But we really need that at the federal level.
And so just last week, a bill that Senator Dan Sullivan had sponsored, it passed the Senate. Basically, the two main things it does is it renews some funding for marine debris, but it also allows the State Department to engage other countries on this issue. Do you think that bill is really going to help?
I think that's really important. And first, I have to express my appreciation for Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski for all the hard work they're doing on the marine debris issue. I know they're really, really passionate about it, and they're working hard on it. I think it's important that this bill passes so that whenever there's any kind of international trade deals going on, and our current president wants to do some renegotiation of that, they can start putting the marine debris issue up front and say, listen, your country is contributing all this to this mess that's impacting our shorelines and our fisheries and everything else. Now there's a vehicle to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And it only renews about $10 million annually. And when I was looking at that number, it seemed pretty small, but you said that's actually an increase.
That's a huge increase, because I think NOAA's marine debris budget is usually around $2 million, if that. And so this is a significant increase, but when you think that the marine debris program not only covers the coastline of the United States and its territories, but also covers the Great Lakes coastline, $10 million doesn't go anywhere. I mean, we've estimated it's costing $100,000 a mile to clean the outside of Montague right now, and we still have 64 miles to go on that thing. So,
yeah.
It's a drop in the bucket.
Over how many years have you been cleaning Montague? How far have you gone?
Well, we've spent a lot of years cleaning on the inside of Montague. By the inside, I mean the protected side of Prince William Sound. But on the outside, on the Gulf side, we've been cleaning out there parts of five summers, I think, now. And we've only gone 14 miles. But the debris loads are 20 to 30 tons of plastic a mile.
And so this is incredibly expensive. You guys collect this plastic. You typically store it up in super sacks, these kind of really large nylon bags. And then you guys basically make sure that you have funding to come back in years and do kind of one big load to get this stuff out. How much is this costing you just to collect the plastic? And then how much does it cost you to come get that stuff?
Well, last year, our total cost per pound, and that include not only collecting it and getting it in a super sack, but then hauling it on the barge with the helicopters and getting it to the landfill, our total cost was $1.52 a pound. And when we first started doing this with volunteers and small crews 10 years ago, it was costing $4 a pound. That's not including all the volunteer labor and that donated boats and stuff. So we've driven the cost way down, but the only way you get that cost efficiency is by large-scale projects.
And so you guys, you said that you could easily blow through, with a loading operation, you could easily blow through $1 million in the summer?
Yeah, I mean, just keeping a crew and boats and a helicopter, because now you can't, like on the outside of Montague or Kayak Island or any of those, you have to keep your crew on a protected inside, and you have to move them over to the island every day with a helicopter. So you have that cost every day, and you have vessels, and you have barge and helicopters. So We can spend $1 million a year just cleaning up and consolidating debris. The cost of removing it with the helicopters and the barge and the disposal is in addition to that. So it can be quite expensive.
And then that's kind of seems like just the first part of it. And then getting it recycled can also cost money. Or getting it once you get it out of these remote areas, it's cost money to get rid of it as well.
Right. Last year we were fortunate to have a partner, Parley for the Oceans, underwrote the recycling project. And so we brought a huge barge load, 400,000 pounds, into Anchorage. And we sorted through all that with volunteers. And then Parley took that out to some of their partners, and they're making products out of that marine debris. But that cost them a bunch of money. I'm sure they had well over $100,000. There's no money to be made in recycling marine debris.
And so now, I mean, it's incredibly expensive. I mean, do you think... we were just talking about, top-down legislation. I mean, how do you think this problem could be solved? Do you think it's a preventative measure trying to get less debris into the ocean, or do you think more funding should come first to clean the debris that comes out there?
Well, obviously, you're going to need more money for cleanup, because what's out there is going to keep spinning off and hitting our shorelines for a long time. I mean, every time a researcher goes out there and looks at another portion of the marine environment, they find plastic pollution. It is everywhere out there. It's a huge problem. So I don't know how you really solve the problem, but you get, you know, there's got to be a huge public education campaign that focuses on single-use plastic items. You have to have international efforts that mandate proper landfill practices, disposal practice. You have to have what they call a circular economy, where things are designed to go to from the producer to the consumer and then back to the producer to be reused or recycled again. You know, that has to all be built in. So it's a very complex problem. But I know that, and thank God for organizations like Center for Last Coast Studies that does all this education in the local area, but the vast majority of the marine debris in Alaska doesn't come from Alaska. So you can educate your butts off here, and you're not going to solve the Alaska marine debris problem. So it has to be international in scope.
Mm-hmm. And so what, you know, it's more than just plastic making a pristine beach look ugly. I mean, this stuff breaks down, it gets into very small pieces, and can affect the marine environment. I mean, what are some of the risks that are associated with plastic getting into the ocean?
I think all of us are familiar with the entanglement and ingestion problems. You see the whales and the seals and the fur seals, and you know, all of them entangled, and the turtles, and it goes right on down through. Practically every marine organism will eat plastic if it's presented to them in the right form. And preferentially so, apparently, some of them will eat plastic. And so it's not just that physical impact on the animal, but what really worries me is the biological and chemical impacts on the environment. And we're supporting studies that Mike is doing with the College of William and Mary and others that looking into the chemicals that are leaching out of the plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely having an impact. And people around the world are really getting concerned about that.
Yeah, and Mike, we talked about this a little bit. You've worked on a study. You actually studied the immune systems of fish. That's primarily which you look at. And you have looked at the impact of some chemicals from plastics and how that impacts fish. What have you guys been doing, and what have you been when seeing with that?
So we completed a study in Elizabeth Lake, which is a remote area, you know, pretty close to Homer, actually. And we found that plasticizers, which kind of leach from plastics, get into the fish, for one thing, and we found correlations, dose-dependent correlations with development of the immune system that kind of was pretty significant. So it looks like it affects the production of antibodies in those fish, and of course we don't know what that will eventually do to those fish, but it can't be good if it affects that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in collaboration with John Kennish at UAA, who has since retired. But we have now found another chemist at William & Mary, actually, Rob Hale, who is going to hopefully take over that part of the project. So there's a lot more than plasticizers that will probably have effects, but very little is known about it.
And so this is a big area that scientists will be looking to get into, is figuring out the long-term impacts on marine organisms and fish. And
right. So I think a lot of studies have looked at simply the presence of a lot of those pollutants, but very few studies have looked at biological impact. So my study is one little example. It's a small study, but that starts looking at actual biological effects on the, you know, on the organisms. So, and that, if we see effects in salmon, juvenile salmon, I bet you there will be effects on all vertebrates. I mean, no doubt. I mean, the systems are similar enough
mm-hmm.
that they're all going to be affected, probably.
Yeah, and so, you know, for people that, you know, may be looking to get involved, these remote places are incredibly expensive to get to and hard to get out there to physically clean. And so Henry Reiske is the Marine Debris Coordinator at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, and you guys have been doing some education programs. You kind of want to talk about what programs you guys have been doing here locally on the peninsula and what you guys have been doing.
Yeah. The Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies has been doing marine debris education as well as cleanups in Kashimak Bay for quite a while now. And then most recently, we've gotten a grant from NOAA, which I've been working on for this last year, that allowed us to really expand this program. And what we've been doing is the program called Stewards Targeting Ocean Problems, Stop Marine Debris, where I've been able to go into schools as well as the community and talk to businesses about the problem of marine debris and how we can protect the oceans, particularly focusing on this problem of single-use plastics, telling them about the dangers of the single-use plastics as well as discussing how we can lower the amounts of single-use plastics that are coming through our system so that we can overall lower the amount going into the ocean, and working with schools to eliminate these large sources of single-use plastic that are happening in the students' lunchroom every day.
And just real quick, I want to remind everyone that we will be opening the phone lines here in just a few minutes. That number is 235-7721, or you can call 1-800-979-5224. Again, 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. And so, Henry, looking at the project in the schools, kids were kind of designing their own projects, looking for the places where they're the sources of the debris coming out of their schools. I mean, what did kids find and what kind of projects did they do?
Yeah, the kids had a variety of projects. So the first part of this was them going back and basically doing an assessment of what was coming out of their school. When they did it, some very clear things showed up. For most schools, it was the lunchroom where this plastic was coming from. And then a few real standout sources in the lunchroom being the disposable silverware and trays. There were a few other sources than that, but most schools chose to focus on those disposable silverware. So, for example, McNeil Canyon converted from the disposable plastic silverware to just reusable silverware. A fairly simple switch that's going to make a big change. West Homer here in town was able to go to reusable silverware as well as just the switch from ketchup packets to a pump ketchup dispenser, being able to eliminate thousands of pieces of plastic waste per week.
Yeah, and so we were talking to you guys that this is all funded through a year long grant or
yeah.
And so that funding is going to be coming to an end this fall, but you are going to return to these schools in the spring to take a look at how those projects worked and try to kind of measure the impact?
Yeah. So the larger funding for this program was through this year-long grant. And that allowed us to provide a lot of opportunities for these kids. It allowed us to be able to take them up to Gaia for a multi-day camp that was free to them, and allowed us to take them on some of these bigger trips like the group that I was able to take to Gore Point or the group that I was able to take to Augustine Island. And it just, the money really helped us provide opportunities as well as some of the materials that the students used to eliminate the plastics. But as far as education goes, we can continue this and these projects that the students worked on can continue into the future of the schools. The students worked with all the grades of their school. So generally it was a class or a few classes of school, but they spread that message throughout the school. And we can continue going in, we can continue spreading the message, we can continue working on the projects. And then the money just allows us to do a little more, do some more demonstrating and some more providing to allow these changes.
Yeah, and so we can now open the phone lines. So if you want to give a call, if you have a question for any of our guests, you can call 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. And so you guys have been doing cleanups in Catchment Bay for a number of years. And are you guys going to continue doing local cleanups here?
Oh, absolutely. In September, we'll start again with our Coastwalk program, which is a multi-month effort every fall to clean up Catchment Bay. And so that involves lots of volunteers, lots of hours, and lots of cleanups on our beaches. And that will keep going, absolutely.
And so for anyone that wants to get involved with that, what are some ways they can get involved here locally?
Yeah, very soon we'll be starting out with our cleanups. And we'll have booths, and we'll have displays, and we'll have a kickoff for this big effort. But anybody interested could come by our office at 708 Smoky Bay Way or email me. I'm henry@akcoastalstudies.org to get any of our informational packets, any of our maps, trash bag supplies, borrow gloves, borrow ID sheets. That way people can clean up as well as contribute to our information gathering. We are doing the cleanup every year, but our data is going to contribute to the Ocean Conservancy's International Coastal Cleanup, as well as our own database to allow us what we're seeing. So we're able to see trends in what's happening in Kachemak Bay, since most of what we're finding out in Kachemak Bay is local. It's not sweeping in from other places. What we find here is mostly what we're making here. So when we see changes in our data, it's telling us what's happening in our bay and what we need to address locally.
And I mean, what are you seeing? What kind of things are you guys finding?
The kind of things we find during our cleanups tend to be little stuff. As you saw out on Gore Point, there is little stuff. There's definitely little pieces, but also these large buoys and things like that. We are finding a lot of little styrofoam pieces, but we're also finding, some of our top things are cigarette butts and little pieces of glass just from people around here. Not really properly disposing of them. We've been able to see a drop in some of our larger things. So like wholesale dumping out in Kachemak, people just going down to the beach and dumping stuff doesn't seem to be as much as it was when it first started. A lot of the larger objects are removed. One pretty good thing actually that we've seen through our previous data sets is a reduction in the individual styrofoam. We're still seeing tons of styrofoam coming in from docks and little pieces, but the actual like styrofoam cup, styrofoam takeout containers, there we've seen a change in that in our bay just over the years for the data.
All right, great. And you are tuned to the coffee table. We will take just a couple of minute break. Again, the phone lines are open. You can call 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. You are tuned to KBBI, AM 890 Homer, and you're listening to the coffee table. You are tuned to KBBI, AM 890 Homer. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton, and you're listening to The Coffee Table. And we are talking about all things marine debris. In the studio, I have Chris Pallister, president and co-founder of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, Patty Mikaswalo, scientist and professor at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. Micah also keeps track of the data for Gulf of Alaska Keeper, and Henry Reiske, marine debris coordinator with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. And we were just talking about things that are happening here locally and ways people get involved. But you guys actually, I was lucky enough to be involved in one of those trips out to Gore Point. But you also took a bunch of community members out to Augustine Island. I mean, who were you taking out there, and what's the idea of bringing community members on these remote trips?
Yeah. When we went out to Augustine Island, we were able to take, I believe, 27 people. And that consisted of students who were in the program, some students who are active but weren't actually one of the Zero Waste classes. We had teachers from the Zero Waste schools. We were able to get several activists from the community, from the recycling groups and who participate in cleanups, to come out to Augustine Island as well as another reporter coming back to try to spread the word further, and a photographer to try to bring back a little bit of what was going on at Augustine Island so the people who weren't able to go could see.
And so when we were talking before, the idea behind this is really to get people to see it for themselves, instead of talking about this idea in the abstract. People hear marine debris is piling up on our shores, but when they don't see it firsthand, it's kind of hard to let them know the impact. So what were people surprised when they were out there?
I think a lot of people were surprised. Even me seeing how much comes off the beaches out there, it's a surprise. When you've been living in Kachemak Bay in this kind of isolated area where the trash is not always super visible on our beach, every once in a while it is. And then you go out to these spots that are really taking the brunt of the marine debris. It's pretty eye-opening just to see where it's all coming from, what's all there, how you can walk down a beach for a mile and have skiff load after skiff load of debris coming off. It really shows. And I could load up a trailer and take all the marine debris that we got, or I guess it'd take multiple trailers, from Augustine Island to a school and show, okay, all this came off Augustine Island, but there's nothing that really matches being there and removing it and being part of that process.
And Augustine Island, is that a particular catcher beach? Was it similar to Gore Point in the sense that it would catch more of that foreign debris that we were seeing out at Gore Point?
Yeah. With Augustine sitting out in the inlet, the way that it's catching is it's catching the top side of the Gulf Current as it's doing its cycle. So it's coming up the Gulf and then hitting on actually the northeast side of Augustine Island. It's serving as a catcher beach out there.
Okay. And, you know, and so we're talking about a lot of this debris that's coming from other countries. But, Chris, you know, we were talking when we were out at Gore Point that, you know, the U.S. is actually a huge contributor itself. We're not squeaky clean by any means. Where is our trash going?
Well, it's a good question. I remember right after the Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast and everybody was all excited about that particular incident, but nobody talked so much about the marine debris problem. And then when the Japanese tsunami debris hit here, everybody's screaming to have Japan come over here and clean up our beaches or pay for it, you know. But nobody talked about all the debris that washed off the East Coast and got into the Gulf Current and went to Europe. Our contribution to the mess. I don't generally think the United States is a horrible contributor to the marine debris problem, and nor is Canada. But we're not anywhere near the scale that countries on the Western Pacific side are. But we do have some issues.
And so our debris is primarily flowing out to European countries?
Well, I'm sure you have a big outflow from any of the big river drainages like the Columbia or Mississippi or, you know, places like that. I mean, I've seen pictures where they have nets across the L.A. River, if you can call the river, that concrete aqueduct they have down there where there's a massive amount of bottles collected in there. But, you know, most of our debris, I think, if you looked at it purely by weight and volume, from what we find in the northern Gulf anyway, it's the majority of that is commercial fishing debris. If you look at it as individual items, then it's consumer items. I mean, if anything imaginable, just in gross numbers. But, you know, the commercial fishing industry contributes a tremendous amount to this problem. And I'm not blaming local folks because a lot of what we're seeing, particularly now out on the Gulf, nets and lines and stuff that are drifting across from the tsunami, they just started to really come in the last year or so as our net and line categories are now starting to climb. And so it's they can come from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's a mixed bag.
Yeah. And so just looking, you know, particularly from the fishing industry, we saw, I mean, pretty large buoys out there. And then we also saw a particularly large, I don't even know what I would call it, a big float of some kind. It was on the Gore Point Beach. It was probably nearly 10 feet long. So are you seeing these larger items just starting to show up?
Well, you're talking about that big pipe that was on the North Beach?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that was 40 feet long and 3 foot in diameter and has an inch and a half wall thickness. And according to our estimations, probably weighs about 2 tons. And I suspect that is probably part of a dock or some kind of structure along the shore that was washed out by the Japanese tsunami. I'm looking at the quality of the workmanship, and this wasn't something that was just jury-rigged thrown out in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you, you know, you've discovered what these items are just through years of picking up some of this trash, but you've also taken trips over overseas to take a look at what's going on over there.
Correct, yeah. I've been over to Japan a couple times and looked at their coastline with the Japanese Environmental Action Network and met with the politicians and leaders over there. And it's been really interesting how much the Japanese attitude has changed since the tsunami. Prior to the tsunami, they didn't think they were a big contributor to the marine debris issue. Afterwards, and now the last trip I was over there just last fall, they're that, yes, our coastal villages, particularly their fishing industry, does contribute a lot of marine debris. And they're trying to do something about it on a national level.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys have actually, the Japanese government actually contributed some money for the cleanup here in
yes,
the U.S.?
Yes, they did. They contributed $5 million to the United States. It was supposed to go to the five states that were impacted by tsunami debris plus the territories. But they put it into one pool and it was used on an as-needed basis. So the lion's share of that, I think like $3.5 million of that came to Alaska.
And so when you guys are looking for funding, you're a completely grant-funded operation. What is your primary source of funding to continue some of this work?
NOAA was a big supporter for quite a few years, and then the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council funded us for 4 years, and then we've had different corporations and some amount of small private donations, but it's mostly grants.
Okay, and so and we were talking that you also basically are your own grant writer, that you have to take your own time to basically seek out funding in order to continue this work.
Yeah, I do. I spend a lot of time at that, and I should do that full time, and I should have somebody doing that full time. We just haven't got to that level yet. It's a lot of work, and it's necessary.
And so you guys just basically did the Gore Point trip this year. A typical season. What are you guys cleaning up? How long are you out there?
Well, we actually did a Prince William Sound trip too, which is 14 beaches, and it takes us about the same amount of time as the Gore Point project, but. Typically, we like to keep our crew in the field. We'd like to keep them in the field for 100 days each summer. And they generally work like 30 days, take a week off, work 30 days, take a week off. And by the end of the summer, those guys are trash. But that's a full summer for us.
Okay. And you guys are cleaned at three beaches out of Gore Point and then 14.
In Prince William Sound.
In Prince William Sound. Okay. And are you guys, it sounds like that's keeping you guys incredibly busy. Are you guys looking to expand, or what's the future for Gulf of Alaska Keeper?
We would like to expand. And ideally, I think when we talk about, we'd like to have five organizations like ours in this state that had designated sections of shore, coastline, that they took care of. And, I think we need to have an initial cleanup of all the coastline, which would cost, I'm going to say it here, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And then you need to have five organizations like ours scattered along the state that are doing this on an annual basis, keeping things clean. Because if you don't clean it up, it gets ground up in these little minuscule particles that any organism can pick up then. And, we've seen evidence that everything that is out there, it seems to eat this stuff. Bears, river otters, sea otters, all of it. They're all eating this stuff.
And what organizations are out there cleaning it? What are there other organizations like Gulf of Alaska Keeper working on this issue?
Island Trail Networks out of Kodiak does cleanup work. Center for Alaska Coast Studies, of course. Sitka Sound Science Center doing cleanup work. But there was quite a few more that were doing it, and it seems to have kind of tailed off. And I think that's because the funding has kind of dried up.
And so, again, that bill is going to produce $10 million. What are some other sources of funding you guys are seeing outside of just the government or NOAA? Are there a lot of grants out there in private endowments or things like that?
Well, we're looking at corporate stuff now. It's a little easier to deal with. And we do have some, especially for our monitoring projects, we've had some organization now commit to multi-year funding for those projects, because that's pretty important. The other projects, like with the crew back projects, they're so costly that it's hard to get that kind of money together. You have to have some pretty deep pockets. I mean, to convince somebody to spend $1.5 million a year for a cleanup that's only going to do a fraction of what needs to be done, and it's going to have to be redone in another 5 years in the same area, it's a pretty hard sell.
Okay. Again, we are here in the studio with Chris Pallister, president and co-founder of Gulf Alaska Keeper, Patty Mike as well, a scientist and professor at the College of William Mary University in Williamsburg, Virginia, and also keeps track of the numbers for Gulf of Alaska Keeper, and Henry Reisky, Marine Debris Coordinator for the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. If you have a question for any of our guests, you can call 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. We'll take just a quick break and we'll get back to the coffee table. You're tuned to KBBI, AM 890. You are tuned to KBBI, AM 890 Homer. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton, and you're listening to The Coffee Table. We're talking about marine debris and the issue right here in the Gulf of Alaska. And if you have a question for anything regarding marine debris, you can call 235-7721, or you can call 1-800-979-5224. But we do just have a few minutes left. And, you know, going back, Henry, you know, a couple on the trip to Gore Point, we had two local high school students that were actually able to come out and enjoy, you know, getting to see this problem. Well, not, I guess not enjoy, but enjoy being out at a beautiful location such as Gore Point and actually getting to see this issue firsthand. And what did you, you have, was it a good impact for them? Did they seem to see the issue and what's going on?
Yeah, I definitely think they did get to see what was happening out at Gore Point and see. It's just, it is interesting because they did enjoy their time out at Gore Point. You know, they had a good, they had fun. They were, from everything I saw, very much enjoying running around with the log jams, throwing buoys. and then they get to come back here. And these students are students who are working with me on a very regular basis. They the reason I selected them is because they already have interest in some of these topics. They've already been working with me. They're working pretty actively on our STEM project with us, working on our ROVs and the drone, which we hope to be able to use in the future for our cleanup efforts. And I do think it's just really important to get those kids who are already interested in these opportunities, and then hopefully they will take it back with the school year about to start to the high school where they're where they can make changes there and let the other students know what's happening.
And so you're seeing kids get interest in a lot of your programs and kind of continuing to work with coastal studies and that type of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
and then as far as actually businesses can also kind of get involved, you guys have a Green Star program.
Yeah.
You want to describe what that is?
Yeah, so with the Stewards Targeting Ocean Problems grant, we very much wanted to get to the students to talk to them about marine debris, but then we also wanted businesses to be able to get support and get recognition for what they're doing to help improve their sustainability overall, but also their non-marine debris and reducing single-use plastics. And so we have teamed up with an organization that's been operating out of Anchorage, the Green Star Program, which is out of the Alaska Forum for the Environment. And what it is a program where businesses can basically either demonstrate what they are doing right now to help reduce their impact or get advice and make changes and receive recognition for that with the goal of building of having a recognizable symbol so that a lot of people visiting our area getting large tourist loads over the summer can recognize businesses. There's a lot of people who would like to support businesses that are keeping this place healthy, and so people can support those businesses with a easily recognized symbol, and then also try to build a community of those businesses. You know, get a large group of businesses certified in this so that we can all work together to improve Kachemak Bay.
And what are some things businesses have done to get this kind of recognition?
Yeah, businesses are often looking for things that pay off in multiple ways. So not necessarily marine debris, but a very common Green Star situation would be a conversion to LED lighting, you know, which a business can save money as well as reduce their impact. Another change could just be how you package your products or the plastic bags that you sell things in. Moving from plastic bags to, you know, simple as paper bags, or ideally having a reusable option that you could give to people.
Okay. And, you know, I remember when we were out at Gore Point, we were all kind of talking about some of these options aren't easy for people to switch in their own lives or businesses to get away from using styrofoam. I remember we were talking about styrofoam particularly is a hard option to get away from some businesses. But what are some things people can do or businesses can do? Maybe Chris, if you want to talk about this a little bit, that you've seen that can work or that can help reduce some of this problem.
Well, unfortunately, that hasn't been my focus like Henry's has, trying to, mine's been cleaning up the mess people make and not preventing them from making it to start with. So my big thing is making sure that businesses internalize the cost. And I see styrofoam, I see all this commercial fishing debris on the beaches, I see all this stuff is a failure of capitalism. And, you know, they're maximized profits, externalized cost, and that's exactly what that is. And to me, it's capitalism doing what it can, make as much money as it can by putting out as little outlay as possible, but that's where you need strong government. And to me, the marine debris issue is greed and a failure of good government to control it. And so, you know, I'm looking at it from a different perspective than most people.
And, you know, how big is the issue itself? We were kind of talking about on our break a little bit that it's not just washing up here in the Gulf of Alaska or in the Asian countries.
As I mentioned earlier, every corner of the marine environment that a researcher look at is polluted by plastic. And when you consider that two-thirds of the world's surface is water, it's a marine environment, and it's all polluted, it brings it into proportion. You know, it's staggering. And as far as I'm concerned, the only environmental issue worse than the marine debris issue is global warming and all of its ramifications. It is really a serious, serious issue, and it's impacting fish and wildlife all over the world, and indirectly, or not, if not directly, human health. And we need to do something about it. And we are the cause of it. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe we can go redirect that question back to Henry as far as those people looking to reduce their impact, you know, and about what Chris and Gulf Alaska Keeper are seeing, and also what we're seeing right here in Kachemak Bay. What are some things people can do in their own lives to help reduce single-use plastics? Because as I know, after being out at Gore Point, I came back and it was, you know, kind of realizing that, you know, I've tried to be conscious in the past, but realizing how hard it is to get away from plastics itself.
Yeah. What I've been telling all the students, I think one of the strongest things we can do is just think about the plastic we're using. Is it a wise decision? There are some areas in our life where plastic is going to be our option, but there's a lot of areas where it's really not. Thinking about, is this a good use of a really long-lasting, potentially toxic, high environmental cost product to use for a couple minutes, and just think about the products you're using, because there are alternatives, and that's one of the things that the NOAA grant has helped us do is give these alternatives, help people see the other sources and give them the opportunity to, without cost themselves, have these resources, like a reusable sandwich box or a reusable water bottle or a reusable grocery bag. Those are three simple changes that can eliminate three of the largest, you know, individual marine debris pieces.
And, you know, and when looking at certain things, you know, if I look at, if I'm at the grocery store looking at packaging, you know, sometimes when I'm looking for that option that has less plastic or maybe has a reusable option to it, those options can tend to be a lot more expensive. I mean, what would you suggest for people when they're looking at some of those options? You know, is it cheap? Do you find it cheaper in the long run to invest in those options in the first place and reduce plastic down the road? Or
yeah, absolutely. So part of our grant through the Zero Waste Schools program allowed us to buy a reusable lunch kit for every student participating. These lunch kits cost it. Well, every lunch kit was under $10. And with that lunch kit, as long as it's being used, a kid does not have to bring a single-use plastic to school anymore. They can stop what, you know, potentially could be, you know, a sandwich bag, a snack bag, and a reusable spork. That's three pieces of plastic a day throughout every day of the school year just with this, you know, $10 kit. And we had to, you know, kind of mass produce these kits. If you're looking locally and you're maybe salvaging things or going to the thrift store, you can produce that kit for yourself for a lot cheaper than that.
Great. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining me here on the coffee table. And again, we had Chris Pallister, president and co-founder of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, and Patty Zwalo, scientist and professor at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and Henry Reiske, marine debris coordinator with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. You are tuned to KBBI AM 890 Homer. Stay tuned for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne next.
For the Homer area today, rain and a high near 64 degrees. East